This is Fresh Air. President Clinton has asked us to make financial sacrifices so he can cut the deficit. His economic plan calls for a new energy tax and increased taxes for wealthy Americans and corporations. The president is also calling for spending cuts in defense, Social Security, and Medicare and Medicaid payments to doctors and hospitals. To figure out if the sacrifices are justified, you need to understand what the deficit is all about. So as Congress debates the president's economic plan, we've invited Robert Krulwich to help us understand the much-talked-about deficit. Krulwich is a CBS TV economics correspondent and a former economics correspondent for NPR. Let's start with the basics. What's so bad about the deficit? Is it necessarily such a terrible thing?
Well, you know, it's not always a bad thing. Everybody has a little deficit of their own, a private deficit. Everybody owes money to somebody. The problem becomes if you owe so much money to somebody right now that you have to, that you're unable to afford either the necessities of life or you're so squeezed by your obligations that you have no freedom to make choices and new choices. And I guess the real question about the deficit is, are we now or are we approaching the point where we owe so much money to so many people that, A, the government doesn't have any room to maneuver, that we don't have, we can't start new programs. And remember, deficits are about debts. Those are about old obligations, things that have already happened. People say, well, what about the future? What about new challenges? Do we have enough money for new challenges when we're still paying off old obligations? And the second question about the deficit is, are we selfish as a generation right now? Are we gobbling up all kinds of services and making our kids pay for it? Those are the two things that I think most people worry about. The first question, are we in trouble because we're pinched? Not yet. But if the present pattern continues, if the United States does not get richer and richer and richer pretty fast year after year, then all the money that we owe, which is being added to every year, does begin to pinch and does make it much harder for us to create pools of money to address new problems and solve new issues. And as for our selfishness as a generation, I think it's a fair argument. Remember there was a very famous television ad in some campaign where a baby is born and you see him crying in the crib, and then this horrible-looking guy leans over the crib and says, "Happy birthday. Welcome to the world. Here's your bill for $13,000. You're part of the national debt." And the baby goes, "Wah!" That image, which is a very effective image, is not without some truth. If the baby's income is going to be $300,000 a year by the time he or she is 30, no problem. But if the baby's income is going to be close to our own incomes, then that would represent a big, big piece of that kid's taxes, taxes that he or she will pay to pay for things that happened long ago in the 1980s and 1990s. And that, I guess, is a fair worry. The only caveat is if America in the next 20 years does become very competitive and very prosperous, then the fears of a looming deficit just diminish, just as if I told you, Terry, that you were about to become the anchorina of both NBC, CBS for $15 million a year, then whatever obligations you have would seem to diminish in your own mind and in reality.
Robert, is anybody arguing, hey, don't worry about the deficit, no big deal?
Yes. Lots of people are arguing that, and they have two arguments, or three. First say, it is a big deal, but it's not as big a deal as other deals, like getting people to work. That's an argument you hear a lot around the White House. Second deal is, we are going to be a prosperous nation. The jig is not up. We have a lot of ingredients that make it not only probable, but very likely that we will be a successful nation, and we don't have to be dragged down by this pessimism and whatever. And they have a number in their head. They say, the proportion of money that we as a nation owe is smaller than it has been at other times in history. And at other times in history we pulled out, we can do it again. And the third argument against the deficit is the man on the street argument. It says, well, it's been around for a long time. Everybody on television says it's terrible, but I haven't felt anything. The whoopee answer.
How big is the deficit?
How big is it? It's about $4.1 and some trillion dollars, which, of course, makes no sense to anybody.
Yeah, it's hard for me to grasp what a trillion is.
Well, I have actually a little parlor trick for that. Let me ask you a question, because the lesson of this will be just how big a trillion is. First of all, let's deal with the word a million. Where were you, Terry, a million seconds ago?
I have no idea. How much time is that?
Well, I'm not going to tell you. Just guess.
Well, it's easy. I was probably working here because I've been at it for years. It's the coward's way out of the answer.
The answer is it was 12 days ago. So wherever you were 12 days ago. All right. Now, a billion is, of course, a lot bigger than a million. So let me ask you the same question. When was or where were you a billion seconds ago, if you think you were alive?
Was I alive? I don't know.
Were you alive 31 years and 8 months ago?
Yes.
Then it was you alive when Jack Kennedy was, I guess, like maybe his third month in office?
Yes.
That's where a billion was. Now, I caution you for the next stage here. A trillion is so much bigger than a billion that all bars are off, or all holds are barred, or whatever the expression is. Where were you a trillion seconds ago, if you were anywhere?
I can see I was not born yet.
The date is 29,716 B.C. This is roughly the Stone Age. It's just after the discovery of fire. Now, if you go into the debt itself at $4.1 trillion or so, that's by rough calculation 120,350 years ago, which was before the invention of fire. So this is a very, very, very big number.
So there really is a big difference between a million, a billion,
yes.
and a trillion.
And if you stand at one of these calculators, like in New York City on 6th Avenue, they have the deficit is rising, and these numbers are going up by, you know, millions in no time at all, and billions very quickly, and the portions of trillion, like the second number, changes every month or so. It's just amazing.
My guest is Robert Krulwich, and he's an economics correspondent for CBS TV, former economics correspondent for National Public Radio. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Robert Krulwich, economics correspondent for CBS TV. Where did the deficit come from?
Well, it goes way, way back. When the United States of America was first getting itself together, they had this Articles of Confederation, where each of the colonies had become, in effect, independent nation states. And then they decided to agree to hang together in a loose confederation, something along the model of the attempt to hang the old Soviet Union around a confederation. And it worked about as well. I mean, Virginians weren't getting along too well with Massachusettsonians, and there was a whole issue of how do we come together. When George Washington got in on the act, he and Hamilton decided that they could bribe the various states into a more perfect union if the U.S. government, the new baby U.S. government, assumed the debts of all the colonies. So, if you were looking at the very, 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 very bottom of the pile, down there in the very beginning, let's say somebody, I don't know, in Massachusetts lent some money to the town council of Lexington or whatever, and they promised to pay him back in 5 years or whatever, and that IOU when the United States was born, was assumed by the United States as an obligation of the United States, and they had to pay it off. When the 5 years came up, they probably borrowed money from someone else to pay back the loan, and so the note sort of stayed down there at the bottom of the pack. So it's very, very old. The United States of America as a country has never, ever eliminated the debt. They got really, really close once in the 1820s. Andy Jackson was elected president in 28. And in that time, 1828, and around then, he decided that the Northwest Territories, that is a lot of Ohio, Indiana, and a good deal of the Great Lakes, sort of eastern Great Lakes area, should essentially had a fire sale. And he offered the land to farmers, I think it was for $1 an acre or $2 an acre. And a lot of people from Europe and all over came running over and paid the United States Treasury for plots of land. And the USA was swamped with money in 1827, 28 or so, thereabouts. And they got almost down to paying down all of the debts that they had, and it was very, very close to zero. At Inauguration Day, you remember, Andy Jackson had a big party, and everybody came in and ate the cheese and whatever. And about 3 years later, the deficit got off the sort of near bottom and began to go up again. And it has gone up in fits and starts ever since.
So some of the deficit goes back all the way to the beginning of the United States.
Well, even before the United States.
Right. How have we added to the deficit? What have been the major ways we've added to it more recently?
Well, the biggest ways are we go to war. Whenever we go to war, we borrow a huge amount of money to quickly build airplanes, tanks, guns, and buy ammunition and put everybody to work for the government. The government pays all the checks, and they borrow the money to do it. So there are gigantic increases in the debt in the United States under Lincoln and the United States Civil War, huge increases in the World War I, a mountain of an increase during World War II, and then you get the Reagan years, which is of a different character. But I guess I should say one mechanical thing, because it is a little hard for people to understand. If Mr. Jones in Lexington, Massachusetts, lent the Bay Colony of Massachusetts, or whatever you call it, $20, and he expected to be paid back 5 years later, and if the United States government paid him back 5 years later, why do I say that that IOU is still in the pile? And the reason is, the United States of America, what happens is, when they came time to pay Mr. Jones, they went out and asked Mr. Adams to lend $10, and they used Adams's $10 to pay Jones. And this is a very normal thing with government debt. When it's time to pay the bill on Monday to somebody, they go out and borrow money from somebody else to pay the bill that they have to pay on Monday. So in a technical kind of way, you can say that the original obligation to pay $20 is still there because they never really paid it off. They just borrowed money from someone else. It's literally borrowing from Peter to pay Paul.
When the United States government borrows money,
yeah,
to pay back some of the national debt, who does it borrow from?
Well, that's a good question, because mostly it borrows, until very recently, it borrows from Americans. So a lot of people think, well, so what's the big deal? The United States government is borrowing money from Americans, which means that every year it has to pay interest to Americans. So the money doesn't really leave the country and go to Japan or Germany. The money stays here. So what's the big deal? Well, there's two big deals. First of all, the people who can lend money to the government tend to be richer because they have money to lend. So in a way, this is a transfer payment. Taxpayers pay in money, rich and poor, to Washington. Washington takes out of that pile a larger sum of money every year and pays it back to its creditors, to Mr. Fitzhugh in his fancy car, who has got U.S. bonds and so on. And so there is a transfer payment from the poor to the rich. The debt does have that effect. And also, B, as we all know, for a while in the 1970s and 1980s, starting with sheikhs from the Middle East and then Italians and Brits and Dutch people and then increasingly Japanese people, foreigners began to buy U.S. treasuries, which means that when it comes time for the U.S. to send its interest check, it is sending that wealth, our wealth, out of America, and that would arguably diminish America's wealth. However, you want to know who's paying for the debt right now?
Who?
You. When you put your money in a bank or a savings and loan these days, it's amazing right now, but almost because bankers are so scared after the savings and loan crisis and so worried about lending to commercial enterprises after the tremendous crashes in real estate and so nervous about lending to foreigners after Brazil and whatever, that they love the idea of being able to pay you 2.5% interest on your savings account and take your money and go to the United States government and lend your money to the U.S. government for the deficit and get 5.5% or 6%. That's a wonderful spread at no risk, because unlike Brazil and unlike the 1066 Wilshire Boulevard or whatever, the real estate client that looks good on Monday and doesn't pay on Friday, the United States of America always pays its debts. So the bankers basically overwhelmingly in the last few years have taken a huge amount of the money that you and I bank in our banks and lent it to cover the debt. So when the United States of America goes and asks the entire world, could you lend us money this week, which they do every week, most of the hands that go up, we will, in the room, are American bankers lending American deposits to the United States of America.
So you and I are paying with lower interest rates. We're not making a lot of money on the money in the bank.
Our banks are making money.
Mm-hmm.
Which I suppose we would like, since we don't want them to collapse anymore, but which after a while gets your goat. Because every time you walk into the automatic teller and they charge you 55 cents per transaction, and every time you call up your banker to say hello and he says, that will be $3.45, please, what else? it gets to be irritating that they're also getting, in effect, a subsidy from the U.S. government.
So the way that Americans lend money to the government for the debt is through buying treasury bonds.
Yeah. If you get rid of the word treasury bonds, which sounds inexplicable, it's just an IOU. What you want to know what actually happens, and you can actually dial the number if you want. There's a telephone number which is answered by a man with the most remarkable New York accent you'll ever want to hear, which tells you every day of the week how much money the United States of America wants to borrow from the whole world. So this guy gets you dial the number. And you get on the phone, you hear, he says, this week, the New York Treasury, New York Federal Reserve has an auction on Monday at 10 a.m. Bids will be received for whatever it is, it's quarter, for the outside quarter. Make yourself post off market up quarter. This is a public announcement. If you wish to hear the results of this market quarter, dial the following number. And then you do, if you want to hear. And then what happens is at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, a representative of the United States of America, in effect, goes before the whole world, or there's actually a room, and there's an auction, and he says, I have here an IOU from the U.S. government. We want to borrow, $10,000, we want to borrow $1 billion in $10,000 amounts, and how much would you pay, how much interest would you want to receive this IOU? And so, 1, 2, 3, sometimes 4 times a week, the United States asks the whole world for money. The whole world comes to market and offers the United States, demands various interest rates from the United States. The United States chooses the lowest interest rate that will be able to raise the money. It's just a regular old classic auction. And then they announce it on that telephone call.
My guest is Robert Krulwich. We'll be back in a minute. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Robert Krulwich, CBS TV economics correspondent, former economics correspondent for NPR. President Clinton, I think, is trying to do two things with his economic plan. One is to cut the deficit,
right,
and the other is to stimulate the economy.
Right.
What's the thinking behind the thinking on this?
Well, as you indicate from your tone of voice, these are not necessarily complementary goals in the short term. In the next few years, let's say, next couple of years, if he spends a humptagatillion dollars to create jobs— that is, as everybody who thinks knows, is going to add to the deficit and will create a bigger deficit, not a smaller one, unless he cuts everything else, which is very, very unlikely. So if he's going to launch a big government spending program to stimulate the economy, he has a problem if at the same time he wants to cut the deficit. So that's true. However, it's a different picture in the long term. And it is in the long term where President Clinton mentally and emotionally seems to dwell. He looks at the United States and he sees short-term problems, but he's interested in long-term solutions. And it is his guess that if he can put in place a set of government programs that create educated or more educated people, incentives for small businessmen to hire those more educated people, and a infrastructure that allows them to zing-zang information around the country and around the world, that he will create at least the launching pad for a prosperous country. And he thinks that that, of course, if a country does become prosperous, will produce the wealth that will solve the deficit problem. So whether you're for or against President Clinton's plan, I suppose the way to analyze his plan is to focus either in the short term and then draw a line, because you're not talking about the same thing, or talk about the long term and whether his formula will work. But it is about two different goals in two different time frames.
I read that there's a recovery going on. Should I be feeling that?
Yeah, of course you should.
How?
Well, people around you should be less worried about losing their jobs. People around you should be less worried about their friends and families losing income from whatever source. People around you should be thinking about asking the boss for a higher raise. People around you should be thinking about buying the pair of shoes or the sofa or the wall-to-wall carpet or the washer-dryer that they've had their eyes on for a long time. Appetites should be rising, fear should be dropping, and that's what classically happens in a recovery on the street. People feel, A, a little better about the future, B, less frightened, and C, they pay more attention to their appetites for all kinds of stuff.
I'm not sure that's exactly what I've been seeing. What about
you? A lot of people have. Well, you're not living in Cleveland, and you're not living in Omaha, and you're not living in Austin, or you're not living in some places where I think, or in Denver, where those things are going on. A lot of people are living in places where that isn't happening yet. Let's take California aside. I think most places in the United States are either at a bottom, like that people don't think things are going to get worse, or they're beginning to rise. California is the exception. So a lot of this depends on where you live and where you sit and who your friends are.
Robert Krulwich is economics correspondent for CBS This Morning.